This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for February 2011. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poets reading their poems in the current issue and talk with one of our prose writers.
This month, we're going to hear from Alicia Ostreicher.
Don't they know the first song was a lullaby?
And from Jessica Jopp.
This poem is called Why Poetry Cannot Be Skimmed.
Then we're going to speak with Adam Kirsch about hip-hop.
There's a lot more going on in these rap lyrics than you would find in an anthology of poetry written in the same period.
Also, we have book reviews by Joel Brower and poems by Angie Milinko and Alberto Rios, among others, including this month a long poem by Carolyn Forche. And it's hard to believe, but this is actually Forche's first appearance in the magazine. Isn't that right, Don?
Yeah. We were wondering why that is. I thought everybody wanted to be in Poetry Magazine.
Exactly. You know, she wrote me and said when she sent this poem that she had actually never submitted to Poetry Magazine. And when she was a young poet, she imagined having the star beside her name. All first contributors get a little asterisk or star beside their name. She imagined having it when she was an old poet. And then her email concluded, I am now an old poet. So here we have this wonderful, haunting poem, right,
yes.
Don? It's called Travel Papers.
Yeah. It's a fascinating, undulating, beautiful poem. It sort of follows a road, maybe from Austria to Berlin. It's a little hard to say. Seems to owe certain things to the poet Paul Celan.
Right, and it's going to be included, actually, in an anthology that Ilya Kaminsky is editing of poems that are dedicated to or sort of homages to Paul Celan, although I don't think Celan appears in this poem directly.
Doesn't seem like it. The spirit's there as the poem wanders, like many people and many poets do, from one territory to another.
The poem is about someone who dies in a war, and the poem is intentionally ghostly. If I seem vague on the details, it's because there's a certain wispiness about the details, which is apt for the subject because the poem is eventually about how we recall our lives and how we remember these details of those we love. And this is about someone that the speaker loved who was killed. And early on, we get this hint of Ceylon in these lines, in this beautiful sort of evanescent language. Bells from the tower in the all at once, then one by one, hours. Outside, so fleetingly, ourselves. In a still mirror, in a blue within, where this earthly journey dreaming itself begins, thought into being from the hidden to the end of the visible. That's wonderful because it shows something emerging into consciousness and then being conscious and then leaving consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Leaving consciousness and leaving life.
Right.
Really, where the poem winds up. More beautiful writing here. Did you float toward Salzburg, a wind in the mustard fields, or walk instead beside me through the asylum in Krakow? Hours after your death, you seemed everywhere at once, like the swifts at twilight. Now your moments are clouds in a photograph of swifts. In the hour held open between day and night under the meteor showers of Perseid, we held each other for the last time. Dead, you whispered, where's the road? There. Through the last of the sentences, just there. Through the last of the sentences, the road. And there's a hyphen.
Right. And so the poem fades
points
off
forward
into the ineffable or, you know, I mean, Donald Davey used to despise poems that he said trafficked in the ineffable.
Right.
But that's a very idiosyncratic and eccentric point of view. This poem, I think, very convincingly and beautifully comes to the edge of what language can do and then sort of leaves you looking out over the edge that it has created.
Yeah, it's really, really lovely.
Another poem from this issue that I particularly liked is by Thomas Lynch. And Lynch is actually better known as an undertaker. He's written a couple of memoirs about being an undertaker and his life as an undertaker, but he's a wonderful poet too. In a series of poems in this issue, he writes in the voice of a sin eater. And right, Don?
Right. You don't hear from them every day.
Right. Well, he has a note. That he calls them, you know, common functionaries at funerals in Wales, Scotland, and Ireland, and they would take unto themselves the sins of the dead by eating bread and beer over the corpse. That was their job.
Right. They would charge for this service.
And this one is called He Considers Not the Lilies, But Their Excellencies. You're inside his head, although it is third person. Thin gruel, shallow graves, whiskey watered down, the ne'er-do-well and good-for-nothing crowd of corner boys and gobshites were among Argyle's manifold perturbations. Worse still, the episcopal vexations, their excellencies, eminence, and graces, red-cassocked dandies and metered wankers, the croziered posers in their bishoprics with their Easter duties and Peter's pence, their ledgers full of mortal, venial sins, keepers of the till and tally, bankers of indulgences and dispensations, their bulls and bans and excommunications, nothing but contumely and bamboozles. For all their vestiture, rings and unctions, preaching to bishops like farting at skunks was nothing but a mug's game to the sin-eater. So in earshot of them, mum is what he kept. Still, he thought there might be something to it, a life apart from this life where the souls long dead and gone were neither dead nor gone. Some days he felt so happily haunted by loving ghosts and gods upholding him. Some days he felt entirely alone.
You know, there's an Irish song that says there's lots of fun at Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
And, you know, people think of Joyce, of course, but it's the song. It's about, you know, the corpse getting up to have another drink. And the language and song becomes very lively at that point. As you can imagine, there's, you know, fistfights and stuff like that. And this poem just really brings all that to life.
Yeah.
You know, you'd live to see poems with this kind of language in them.
Yeah, it has a kind of obvious anti-Catholic sentiment to it. But you wouldn't say it's anti-religious exactly or anti-faith. The interesting thing about these poems is the sin-eater has his own kind of very mortal faith.
Right, and the sin-eater has to digest all the sins. So it would be astonishing if they had a kind of more conventional piety.
Yeah, it would be.
I mean, they've got this stuff and it comes right back out at you. And one of the swell things about this poem is, you know, I always look to see how similes are used in poems. It's a test of a poem a lot of times because they're so common. And you got to like that one here, preaching to bishops like farting at skunks.
Yeah, nothing but a mug's game to the scene exactly. Alicia Ostreicher has written 13 poetry collections, and her latest, The Book of 70, received the 2009 National Jewish Book Award for Poetry.
We have a set of four of her poems in the February issue, and they're related. The first stanza in each of these poems is spoken by an old woman, the second stanza by a dark red tulip, and the third by a dog.
You gotta love how dog ending.
Well, these poets just think of the strangest things, right, don't they?
These three characters sneaked up on me a few months ago and have been having their say about a number of things,
including about the origins and nature of poetry, as in this poem called Song.
Some claim the origin of song was a war cry. Some say it was a rhyme telling the farmers when to plant and reap. Don't they know the first song was a lullaby pulled from a mother's sleep, said the old woman. A significant factor generating my delight in being alive this springtime is the bird song that, like a sweeping mesh, has captured me. Like diamond rain, I can't hear it enough, said the tulip. Lifetime after lifetime, we surged up the hill, I and my dear brothers, thirsty for blood, uttering our beautiful songs, said the dog.
Well, I love the way she puts these three things together and sort of says, make of it what you will. One of the things that I especially like is that schoolmarmish language with which the second stanza starts, a significant factor generating my delight in being alive. And then you don't get the fact that this is a tulip speaking until the end of the line. You think it's the old woman still. And so the poem surprises you right up until the end. Right?
It is very surprising. And the variations from poem to poem are surprising too. There's no rut here.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this particular poem in the set is that it does look at the origin of song. And what's arresting about it is right off the bat, this claim that you hear a lot.
Some claim the origin of song was a war cry. Some say it was a rhyme telling the farmers when to plant and reap.
The poem asserts, didn't they know the first song was a lullaby pulled from a mother's sleep, said the old woman.
Yeah, which puts it in a woman's consciousness, because we think of poetry as a masculine endeavor from way back. And these are masculine things that she starts out with, a war cry and the farmers. And then she says, no, it's a feminine origin.
It is. And the male presence here, for instance, the dog, there's a strange creative tension here. I mean, there's a dialogue back and forth between all these really juxtaposed kinds of things, you know, a tulip, an old woman, and a dog, and yet they fit together. I mean, you can see a dog and a woman and a tulip. Only a poem can really navigate among these separate characters so wittily and deftly.
It does create a masculine-feminine tension, because you could read it as becoming masculine there at the end. My dear brothers. Exactly.
Thirsty right, for
which
blood.
Is, which is warm kind of talk. You know, in lifetime after lifetime, we surged up the hill. And then it's made into not a man, but a dog. So it's, there's a comment here on where song comes from and maybe what men do to song.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a real question there. Can the lullaby withstand all of the insistent rhetoric and violence that also exists in the world being sung to?
Yeah.
Well, in this set of poems, the order of speakers is always the same. First the old woman, then the tulip, then the dog. We asked Alicia Ostreicher about this order.
I think the old woman gets to talk first because she's probably closest to my surface. So she most easily is able to say, hello, I have something to say.
Here's what she had to say about her other characters.
Well, the tulip is so self-centered. She's so narcissistic. Everybody seems to like the dog best. He's like a divided personality. And I think maybe people like that about him, although his divided personality leans toward the physical, and the physical leans toward the raunchy.
You'll hear what she means by raunchy in the next one we're going to play for you. This one's called In Every Life.
In every life, there's a moment or two when the self disappears, the cruel wound takes over, and then again, at times we are filled with sky, or with birds, or simply with the sugary tea on the table, said the old woman. I know what you mean, said the tulip, about epiphanies. For instance, a cloudless April sky, the approach of a butterfly. But as to the disappearing self, no, I have not yet experienced that. You are creating distinctions that do not exist in reality, where self and not self are like salt in ocean, cloud in sky, oxygen in fire, said the philosophical dog under the table, scratching his balls.
Now that reminds me of the sin eater, right?
Yeah.
Pulling you right back down to ground.
Yeah, well, all of these creatures are rooted when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the old woman with her sugary tea on the table, there's the gravity of that life that she's had to lead. And then, of course, the tulip is rooted in the ground and sort of incapable of experiencing these epiphanies.
Or our dividedness, right?
Then the dog chimes in with his itchiness.
Yeah, and the great thing is what the dog says, it is actually profound.
Where self and not self are like salt in ocean, cloud in sky, oxygen in fire.
I mean, he's under the table scratching his balls, and yet his philosophical statement is a wise one.
And yeah, yeah.
They say that, you know, philosophy often kills poetry because it's a kind of lead weight that enters the poem, and people begin dealing with these abstractions and trying to push them around, and not many poems will bear that. This poem has a wonderful lightness in dealing with a subject that's been in Western consciousness for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this poem creates distinctions that do exist in reality.
Yeah. This is the first time that Jessica Jopp has appeared in poetry, and we have three of her poems in the February issue.
Her first book is called History of the Voice. She teaches poetry at Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
I taught a poetry workshop last spring, and during student conferences, I'd questioned a student about the reading, and it seemed as if he hadn't read the assigned poetry very well. And he told me that he just skims the poetry right before class. So this is written in response to that student.
Fortunately for that student, he's not named in the poem, and Jopp's response is not a lecture, but the slow and careful development of a metaphor for where poetry comes from and what it is.
Here's Jessica Jopp reading Why Poetry Cannot Be Skimmed.
The barn was in the Netherlands, in a field where fierce night wind caught the straw as if to fuse the winter stars to their coldness. A farmer, woken by the sound, knowing his animals would be agitated, walked to the barn and by lantern brushed the tails of his horses. And calming them, he gathered many long gleaming strands of their nut-brown hair, given over to what he heard in the swishing of their tails, the lash, the taut string of grief turned slow, persistence turned a rhythmic movement. He hoped that if he listened long enough, the layered sound would become a salve. He rolled the strands together, laid out along the windowsills of the barn. Then, once dry enough in spring, he rolled them in paraffin wax to preserve the sound and left them to absorb all the varied rays of sun, the spills of rain, and then snow flying fast across the latched windows and the slats, the rhythm of other breathing, animals plodding by the barn walls. The wax melted as the years progressed, and other horses resided in the stalls, and their tail strands were added to the aging threads. From that encased sound, deepening over years, a rope, pulled strong and taut, would resonate. Then another generation worked the land and waxed the horsetail cord again, and in turn, when it caught, that century's light was spun into amber. Woven into the cells of hair, the tones of canal and field, pasture, furrows of plow, leaf and shadow, straw and stone, the human calling, the animal uttering. And when melted again incrementally, strands from other horses living there were added until there were enough layers of sound set with the nourishment of grass and salt to be given away, and the space the hare had occupied would be returned to emptiness. The horsehair cord was brought by a farmer to a luthier's shop along a canal, and it was a perfect fit, she said, for a violin bow she had carved a few months earlier, waiting, and for the bowless violin someone had just given her. She knew rosin carrying a current through pastures filled thirst and the grief of night wind and scavenged apples made the gathered pieces a whole. And now they are together in your hands, this moment to make, unrehearsed, immediate, after all those animals' years, when you bring the instrument to your chin, when you raise the hair-strung bow, again their elemental sounding, and then their measured note, their first.
One thing that stands out about this poem, is in her reading of the poem at least, is the relatively long pauses at the end of the lines.
I think what we're hearing in her reading, among other things, is a kind of variable three-beat line. In other words, many of the lines have very insistent three stresses to them, and then it varies into four. Maybe this is part of what the poem itself refers to as persistence turned to rhythmic movement. The poem says to the student, he hoped that if he listened long enough, the layered sound would become a salve. Maybe there's something that we're hearing in her reading of the poem that it tries to accomplish that, to get you to hear the layers. And
well, Denise Levertov used to say, I studied with Denise Levertov years ago, she used to say that the poem was a score and that you'd better read your poem as if the score made sense.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't stand for anybody to actually read past the lines, read over the lines. She demanded this long pause at the end of the lines, and that never caught on among poets.
Right. I think Creeley has done that.
Yeah, Creeley does it. And all of those poets who make those sort of sculptural sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But this poem is different because it's really a kind of narrative. It's not carved in the same way that those poems are. Your eye would naturally and ear would naturally flow through this poem. And her reading of it seems to want to disrupt that slightly.
Yeah, I think so. Well, there's probably a natural impulse there to keep the student awake. to keep the reader going.
Probably so.
And there, that's a kind of pedagogical insistence, among other things. I mean, it's not merely that.
One of the great things about the poem, though, is its lack of pedagogical insistence in that it doesn't – it has the title, but then it goes on, and the poem is nothing about this, apparently, right?
Right.
It's about all these other things and how out of these horses' tails is made this bow. And
it finds its own music.
Right.
The horsehair cord was brought by a farmer to a luthier shop along a canal, and it was a perfect fit, she said, for a violin bow. That's so unusual, but you can see it perfectly. I mean, you can hear it.
And so here's a metaphor for how a poem exists in our consciousness and in our lives. And according to her, each reading, if we read the end of the poem, each reading is the first reading, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it has not been read before.
Mm-hmm.
And so each time it happens, it's being written and read essentially for the first time.
Right. It's an elemental sounding, the poem says.
And so you better bring all of your consciousness to it. But also, there are all kinds of things implicit in that assumption. One is we're never experiencing the same poem.
Right.
We're all experiencing slightly different poems. So there is no poem or meaning to get out. I wonder how she handles that in her classes. You know.
Well, but that's why poetry cannot be skimmed.
You
know, you have to not skim the surface, but sort of wade into it and out of it.
Word. See my homeboys cooling way out. Told them about my morning cold, bugged them out. Shot a little dice till my knees got sore. Kicked around some stories about the night before.
Late last year, Yale University Press published the Anthology of Rap, a collection of lyrics edited by Adam Bradley and Andrew Dubois. Early reviews complained about transcription errors, but now that the dust has settled just a bit, Adam Kirsch is here to review not only the book, but also the idea behind the book.
Adam Kirsch is a poet and critic, and both his poems and criticism have appeared in Poetry, and he's been on our podcast before. He joins us again by phone from New York. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
So the first question is, are you a fan of hip-hop and rap?
I can't say that I was, before reading the book, a big fan of hip-hop or rap or knew a lot about it. I sort of approached it not a totally blank slate because, of course, everyone has heard some rap and knows a little bit about it. And I am part of the generation that grew up listening to it, so I remember listening to Run DMC and Beastie Boys starting in elementary school. But it wasn't really my scene, so I was coming to it in a spirit of discovery and trying to think of what hip-hop could teach poetry.
Well, you note that a lot of the lyrics in the book haven't actually been written down, and they had to be transcribed from the music. So how would you compare the experience of listening to rap and reading rap lyrics?
Well, this is one of the big controversial claims of this book, this anthology. The editors of the book invite us to read rap lyrics as poetry, and they refer to MCs, the people who perform and write the lyrics, as writers, primarily as writers, and which is not the way that we experience them most of the time or that they intend to be experienced. They are performing artists, recording artists, and really we listen to them more like as singers than we do as writers. So there's definitely a lot of dimensions missing when you just read the words on the page. You don't hear the tone of voice. You don't hear, obviously, any of the production effects, the tunes, the samples, beats, or any of the things that make a song. You're just approaching the lyrics in isolation and trying to make them work as poetry.
Now, despite that, you have high praise for the verse technique in rap. And you even say that when it comes to
see how in a pretty short period of time, and this book covers the period from the late 70s to the present, which is pretty much the whole history of hip-hop, that the level of sophistication of metrical sophistication of rhymes and rhythms really skyrockets, and you can see it progressing very rapidly. One of the sections of the book is called The Golden Age, and you can see this sort of golden age happening where more and more people get interested and they keep raising the level of what's possible in terms of verbal sophistication.
And you think that's actually better, you say in your essay, that it's actually more sophisticated, more artful than the American poetry written in the same period.
Definitely in terms of verse technique, I think
it is.
Right. If you're talking about things that have always been considered the building blocks of poetry up until the 20th century, things like rhyme, meter, even simile and metaphor, there's a lot more going on in these rap lyrics than you would find in an anthology of poetry written in the same period.
Now, you write about the distinction between the writer of the rap and the MC who performs it. They're the same person, and yet in a very important way, you know, they're not. So how does that contrast apply to the idea in poetry of a writer and a speaker?
Well, you do have in poetry the idea of a speaker or a dramatic monologue or a persona poem, where there's a pretty clear distinction between the person who's doing the writing and the person whose voice you're hearing in the poem. You see that, for example, in Robert Browning's monologues or in the persona poems of Ezra Pound. That's a convention that readers of poetry are familiar with. But when you read a poem in which the first person is used, when the poet says I, we usually think of that I as standing in a pretty close relationship to the poet, that is a way of expressing the poet's own experience and feelings, even though it's never totally autobiographical. There's a lot more distance between the writer of a rap lyric and the character who you see in that rap lyric, and you can see that just in the way that rappers use these sort of outrageous stage names, making up names that make them sound often like superheroes or cartoon characters, that there's something larger than life going on in the way that they present themselves in their lyrics. A perfect example would be Eminem. He's someone who introduces lots of different characters and personas into his work. So some of the songs are supposed to be by Marshall Mathers, which is his real name. Some are Eminem. Some are Slim Shady, which is a different character. All of them sort of heightened and exaggerated versions of himself.
What you say there makes me think that there's sort of an elastic version of the speaker or the singer, and yet you say in your essay that the insistence on authenticity brings rap closer to lyric poetry than to popular music. What do you mean by that insistence on authenticity if, in fact, they're creating these characters who are larger than life?
Well, there's a tension, and in fact, one of the most interesting things in the anthology is there's a afterword by Chuck D from the group Public Enemy in which he talks about how there's really a taboo on performing lyrics written by someone else, which is one thing that makes rap more like poetry and less like, for example, rock music or Tin Pan Alley, where there are songs that can be performed by lots of different musicians. In rap, you're supposed to only perform things that you've written yourself, and the idea is that that's because you're writing about yourself, that this is some sort of authentic personal expression. And yet, when you look at it, especially in some of the more outlandish subgenres like gangster rap, if you look at some of the Ice-T lyrics that are in the book, they're outrageously violent, misogynistic, homophobic, all the things that people always complain about rap. And then you look at the actual Ice-T, and he's an actor who goes on to be on a TV show. You could say the same thing about a lot of rappers. Even the most sort of once controversial rappers then go on to be on MTV reality shows. And you realize that these people are really entertainers who are trying on different personas, that there's not as much authenticity as the lyrics seem to suggest.
That macho element of rap that you're just describing, which includes the way MCs crow and compete with each other, is possible because you're saying that rappers play by the same rules. Now, among poets today, and they're competing with each other too, there really aren't the same rules to play by anymore, are there?
It's true, and it's one reason why the approach to competition is so different. There have been moments in the history of poetry where poets knew each other and competed with each other in a very straightforward way. And a lot of those are great moments, like in Elizabethan England or in Dante's period in Italy, where you have competitions of poets writing back and forth to each other. Today, with our poetry culture the way it is, I think the element of competition is very much reduced, and there's sort of a bad odor to the idea of competition. Poets would much rather be supportive of each other and would be colleagues rather than competitors. And, of course, a lot of poets would just say that they're not even trying to do the same thing as other schools or other groups, because the idea of what it means to write a poem varies so much between different writers. Whereas with these lyrics in the anthology of rap, there's a very direct competition where each rapper is measuring himself against other rappers, against predecessors, and often uses the metaphor of battle and combat to describe the process of writing.
Do you think poetry could benefit from this? Do you think there's maybe something in Poetry Magazine we could do to encourage this kind of thing?
I think rap battles in Poetry Magazine, definitely. We need to get an 8 Mile feature going there.
You know, it seems pretty clear that one of the aims of the anthology is to elevate rap culturally to the level of poetry or something like that. But does it succeed in doing this?
I think in the end, at least for me as a reader, I came away appreciating the lyrics as verse a lot, but still thinking that they don't do what I expect poetry to do, because they don't encompass enough of human experience, that the subjects and the themes tend to be very limited and stereotyped, And you see the same kinds of boasting, the same kinds of macho posturing again and again. And there's not really a sense of exploration in these lyrics. So the technique is very high, but the goal, I'd say, is different from the goal of poetry.
Well, Adam, thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
You can read Adam Kirsch's essay on rap lyrics and everything else you heard on this podcast in the February issue of the magazine or online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.